Good evening.
Good evening.
Wow, it's really nice to be here again and to see so many familiar faces and friends. And are there any new people here this evening? So welcome. Glad that you're here. And for those of you that don't know me, my name's Catherine Stark, and I began Zen practice here and Zen practice in general in 1990, and I was practicing in Monterey, where I lived at the time, and also here in Santa Cruz. I would come up from Monterey for weekend sittings and for five-day and seven-day sessions at Jikoji, which we used to do up there. I don't know if you're still doing Jikoji sessions, but and so I have a long history with Santa Cruz Zen Center, and was actively practicing here recently for quite a few years. Went through a serious car accident and long recovery and lived next door, and then after my recovery, I went back to school because I had been a massage therapist, and because of my injuries, I couldn't go back to massage. And I had been kind of dancing around chaplaincy and spiritual care, and so it just sort of picked life. As Blanche Hartman, former abbess of Santa Cruz Zen Center, says, sometimes life jumps. And so it's sort of like my life jumped, and it picked me up and put me over here. And so then I spent the next 5 or 6 years actually doing the training and the education to become a chaplain. And until just recently, I was working at Hospice of Santa Cruz County as a chaplain. So this path has been very interesting and varied. I was ordained as a priest in 2003 by Catherine Thanis, the abbot, former abbot here, and received Dharma transmission in September from Shosan Vicky Austin from San Francisco Zen Center. And so what I would like to speak to you about is this process that one goes through to come to this place of becoming a Dharma teacher, and what that might mean or not mean. It's kind of mysterious, and I'm not sure that it's really completely become clear. I have a little more clarity about it, but I'm sure it will be a lifelong learning and growing into it. And so I just thought I would share some of my thoughts with you, because I would imagine that those of you that know about or have heard about Dharma transmission might have some ideas about it. I certainly did. And I have to say that back in 1990, if someone had told me that I would someday be a Dharma teacher, I would have scratched my head and thought, I don't know about that. But it's interesting because when we set an intention, we don't know where the intention will lead us, but if we have trust in the intention, then we can have trust in where it does lead us. So I just also want to say thank you to this center, to the people who have kept it going and are maintaining this place of practice and intention to live our lives in a way that is beneficial and helpful and wholesome and addresses root causes of suffering. So Dharma transmission You know, it really has to do, or one of the things that it is certainly a core or central concern of Dharma transmission is the carrying on of the lineage in this tradition of Soto Zen. And the lineage goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And that's something that, even though I had read and studied and heard a lot about the various teachers and central figures in our lineage down through India and China and Japan, I have to say it wasn't anything that really sunk in. I didn't feel like a real visceral connection. I mean, these were people who lived, you know, hundreds, thousands of years ago, and somehow something wasn't, it wasn't like that feeling of a real deep connection. Like even Suzuki Roshi, who I never met, I mean, I certainly would have loved to have met him, and you know, read and heard and seen video and so forth. It really didn't sink in a way that I really felt a strong sense of what that meant. And I think sort of the turning point for me, it might have even started really when I went to Japan. I went to Japan in 92 for 6 weeks and did a practice period at the home temple of Suzuki Roshi. And my job there the whole time, I was very new to practice, only had been practicing about a year and a half when this trip happened. And it was 12 women, mostly connected with San Francisco and Berkeley Zen Center, and a couple of us from, well, three of us from Monterey Bay Zen Center. And my job at the temple during the practice period was chidan, the person who takes care of the altars and sifts the ashes, sort of like, you know, Cinderella. and there's, in the back of this altar, there's a little kaisando or founder's hall where the people in this lineage, the teachers for this temple are honored. And the one at Rinso-in, the temple in Japan, is a building that it's connected to the main temple. It's kind of a wing that kind of ascends. It sort of has three levels and ascends. And all there's altars all along the sides. And there's statues and plaques, the memorial plaques. And there's about six different places where... And there's a main altar in there, but there's also all the side altars where there's like six or so different places where incense can be offered. And I was taking care of all these altars. And still, even though, you know, I was getting a sense of it, it just hadn't really sunk in. And I was so new and young in practice that the very second day that we were there, you know, we're still jet lagged, you know, flying from San Francisco to Japan, and the very, not the very next day, but the next day, it was the second day, there was a field trip that went to Hakuin's temple, and I, you know, I was totally clueless, you know, I didn't really, I mean, I kind of had heard of Hakuin, but he's the great Rinzai master, and one day a year they display his paintings. He was a painter, and you know, I was so out of it, I didn't want to go. And another one of the people, we decided to stay. I mean, we had a wonderful time too, but I didn't want to go the very first thing, just go, you know, gallivanting off somewhere. But had I known what a wonderful opportunity that was and the significance of Hakuin, I mean, I just would have gone in a heartbeat. But you know, I just was very, you know, new and naive to practice. And And then we went to Eheiji and we saw, you know, Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, Dogen's writings, and, you know, still just, you know, I hadn't matured enough. I hadn't, you know, had the depth of practice, I think, to really appreciate the opportunity that I had been given in going to on this experience, this trip, this journey. But in 96, I went to a conference in Palo Alto that was on Suzuki. The topic was Suzuki Roshi, and lots of his former students came, and his son came, and there was just a lot of presentations and talking from his students about how this person had deeply touched their lives and what it had meant to them to study and practice with him. And somewhere during that day, something shifted, and suddenly I had this kind of really visceral feeling of, and also a visual kind of image of all these people who had stepped forward and expressed this intention to hold this teaching and carry it forward and pass it on to the next person, who then carried it and passed it on and took responsibility for maintaining the practice and the teachings. And suddenly it just really sunk in, like, oh my goodness, you know, this, I could see this line of people stretching back infinitely and also stretching forward infinitely. And something inside me said, yes, I didn't know what that meant, but I just, this deep desire came up of feeling like, I don't even know if it's a want, but it was just, yes, that intention of holding and carrying and taking care of this practice. And I didn't know what that would mean for me or how that would manifest, but I think it was around that time that I started thinking about ordination. And, you know, one of the things that we do in preparing for this transmission, a friend of mine she's not a Zen student or doesn't have any connection with the practice, she said, you know, she had been hearing about this Dharma transmission, and she said, it sounds so science fiction-y, you know, that you're getting transmitted, and it sort of made me laugh. But one of the, so we study some of Dogen's writings that have to do with Dharma transmission as part of the process, and one of them is called Kato, which is Dogen translates as twining vines, but it, the term actually is also translated as meaning complicated. And the focus of the fascicle is about the student-teacher relationship, and the twining vines refer to the word kato comes from katsu, which is wisteria, and to is arrowroot. So the combining of the two into kato, Dogen translates as twining vines, and he talks about how the nature of a vine is that it needs support in order to grow. And so you have student and teacher as these two twining vines growing and supporting each other. And so I think points to a very important aspect of our practice, is that it is accomplished in relationship, that we don't do this alone, that it really is about face-to-face and being in relationship and finding that connection. And this has to do with, you know, the central focus of our practice is dropping the self and finding that deep interdependent and interconnected relationship with each other. And as I was thinking about this talk, which actually I've given a couple times now since transmission, so you're getting the like third iteration of this, but it's kind of neat because you get to kind of find different things to think about. But I was looking for some poems that might have something to do with this, and I found this wonderful haiku poet, a woman, a Buddhist nun from the 18th century. Her name is Chiyo Ni, and she was a Pure Land Buddhist nun, and she's Kaga no Chiyo, I guess is her full name, is considered one of the foremost women haiku poets, and she began writing at the age of 7. She studied under 2 haiku masters who had themselves apprenticed with the great poet Basho. And in 1755, Chiyo became a Buddhist nun, not, she said, in order to renounce the world, but as a way to teach her heart to be like the clear water which flows night and day. So she wrote this haiku that says, "From the mind of a single long vine, 100 lives opening." And when I think of the lineage and what we, I'm not sure what we accomplish, but what is possible in this practice is that when we, each of us, sit down with intention, we are supporting and extending support to everybody else's practice. And we are also receiving the support of all beings, of all things. So it's equally extending and receiving. So there's no separation in this, what Dogen calls imperceptible mutual support. This is explained in another fascicle of his called Bendowa, which is the wholehearted practice of the way. And the term Jijuyu Samai, which is self-employing and receiving samadhi. So samadhi is concentration. And so as we are employing extending by employing this practice of zazen and concentration and extending our intention, we are extending that support outward to all things, and it equally comes back to us as we extend and receive. So there's this kind of circular nature of support. So as we completely, even if we don't think we are, being our authentic selves, we are encouraging and offering support for others to do likewise. So this is what I feel is really the crux of a Dharma teacher, is to support the practice and encourage others in their practice and realize this deep interconnectedness of teacher and student. And, you know, a teacher can't be a teacher without the student. And sometimes the student is the teacher. And I think that any teacher who doesn't think that they're still a student is in trouble. So, so the first as it's come down to us, the first Dharma transmission happened when Shakyamuni Buddha was lecturing to the assembly, and it is said, and Dogen says, he held up a flower and winked, and Mahakashyapa, you know, they met, their gaze met, and Mahakashyapa smiled. So something was extended and received on both sides, and Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, recognized that in Mahakashyapa, that the Buddha acknowledged that what he understood, Mahakashyapa understood, in that exchange. So we, in our tradition, we call it face-to-face transmission. And several questions come up for me about this face-to-face is, who did they see? Who was seen? Another question that came up for me and still comes up for me is, who is transmitting and who is receiving and what is transmitted? I think essentially that no one and no thing is transmitted, or no one is receiving, no one is transmitting. And yet, each is receiving and transmitting. And what is received or transmitted is nothing more than what we already have or are, as Dogen would say, that all beings are Buddha nature. So, as I understand it, what is being acknowledged is that which is already there. And it's a seeing and being seen. It's also talked about as a great round mirror transmits to a great round mirror. Face-to-face transmission cannot be accomplished without student and disciple mirroring one another, becoming entwined, seeing Buddha in each other, and thus all Buddha ancestors in the other. And Chico Lindekutz, the abbess of, well, they're changing that now, anyway, she was the abiding abbess at Green Gulch and former abbess at San Francisco Zen Center. It's a little confusing to me what's going on, but anyway, she says, it's a quote from her, "The teacher cannot be a teacher unless there is a disciple or student, and a student cannot be a student unless there is a teacher. It is really one word, teacher-disciple. They come up together, each creates and conditions the other. The teacher creates the disciple creates the teacher. That's why it's face to face. You need each other to complete the practice." So, in this teacher, disciple, you know, coming up together, in the complete expression of their own being together, this is mutually supporting and assisting all beings to do likewise. So in the meal chant, when we do the formal Oryoki ritual way of eating, it says something like, may we all realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. So within the singular, there is non-particularity, and within the whole, there is the individual. Everything is included. So both teacher and student kind of work together. It's also talked about like a hen and a chick. So the student or the disciple is pecking from the inside and the teacher is pecking from the outside. And sometimes the teacher's inside and the student is outside. So there's a poem about that by Zhang Guan. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. The chick pecks from within, the hen from without. The chick breaks free through the shell. When hen and chick are both gone, the function has not gone astray. Singing the same song, the mystical voice goes on alone. So it's interesting, when I was ordained as a priest, some part of me felt like an imposter, beginning to wear the ochesa, and I had this image. Well, when I was ordained, I was between two practice periods at Tassajara, and when I left Tassajara, I mean, I knew I was going to be ordained, but I was just felt like, you know, just me. And when I went back to Tassajara, and I suddenly was wearing, you know, an ochesa, and I don't know if it was my imagination or how much was my perception and how much was actually happening, but I felt like people were treating me differently. But even though I felt like something had happened, I didn't really feel essentially any different, you know. And so some part of me felt like an imposter. And I had this image of, even though I was wearing this ochesa, it somehow was floating above me. It hadn't settled on me. It wasn't like I was really wearing, you know, it wasn't like it was really on me or in me or, but when I received this ochesa, I realized that the robe is not a thing. It's really about how we live our life. The robe is, it's our vow. It's, I mean, it is a material thing and it has a lot of symbolic meaning, how it's made and sewn, and there's a lot of lore around the robe about protections and so forth. But I think it's more that the robe is in us, and whether or not you're wearing a rakusu or an ochesa, and no matter what color it is, or whether you are not wearing, have not done that particular ritual, if there is the intention, to me that is the robe. The intention to wake up to the great possibility for transformation, to live this life in a way that brings joy not only to ourselves but to others, and that in bringing some relief or some compassionate way of interacting and relating to others, we bring joy to ourselves. So again, it's mutually supporting, mutually extending and receiving, and that's the robe, I think. So I think maybe I'll stop here, and if there's any comments or questions, maybe I'll read Chiyoni's poem one more time. From the mind of a single long vine, 100 opening lives. Jim.
The story that I've been familiar with is that Dogen studied under many teachers in Japan and found no satisfaction, or at least it sent him to China looking for a true teacher, and he found his teacher there. What do you think he found? What does one look for when they're looking for a teacher? What would let one know that they found a true teacher that they can do this practice with in the way that you're talking?
Well, I can't necessarily speak for Dogen, what he found or what... what was it in Rujing that he somehow connected with? But when I think about teachers that I've studied with here and who somehow resonate something that speaks to me, that's authentic, I guess... And I don't know how each person assesses this. You know, I think it's a discernment that each person has to figure out for themselves. But, I mean, we could ask several questions of, you know, we can notice, like, how does this person who is a teacher, how do they live their life, and how do they express their vow in the world? And how do they treat others? And that's not to mean that somebody's necessarily perfect, because we're all human beings, and sometimes we're more awake in some areas than others, and we all have blinders in certain areas. But and then there's some people who are just, you know, they can really express, and, you know, they can give really good talks, and they can have a way of understanding and expressing it that, you know, is helpful to people, that can really open up the teachings for them. And then maybe on some other levels, they're not so skillful. I mean, we've seen this a lot in America with different teachers who, you know, are brilliant in one area and maybe not so brilliant in another, or not so skillful in another. And I remember Catherine said one time, it's kind of like a marriage. You know, it's like maybe it's chemistry, maybe it's some unknown quality, but I think whatever it is, it has to feel authentic, and it needs to be a person that you can really respect and see that, yes, they are really striving to accomplish and live and express this teaching and this vow in their own life.
Sets out to find a teacher, they'll find a lot of people who have read the teaching and intellectually understand it, but they haven't really fully realized the Buddha's nature of the Buddhahood. And that's what makes a real teacher. A real teacher is somebody who has realized the teaching, not just intellectually understood it, or reading or any other way.
Mm-hmm. sometimes it's hard to know. Yes, Mary.
I imagine that your work as a chaplain would have been a great opportunity to deepen your own practice. Mm-hmm. Could you share a little bit about something to do with that?
Yeah, okay, well, talk about teachers. So in working with people who are experiencing either catastrophic life-changing medical events or one step beyond that into terminal illness, for me, every one of my patients that I've had the great good fortune and honor to walk with a little bit, I see as my teachers, another level of teaching, who are showing me how to do it. And this is all our journey. We're all on this journey of birth and death, the great matter, as we call it. And so having the opportunity to witness the deep courage and grace and struggle and fear sometimes, and how one meets that fear, and to see the transformation that happens as people move into that acceptance of the inevitability of death has been such a huge gift for me. And has been a source of great meaning. And, even though on some levels it can be sad and, feel the grief and the sadness of families, and but also the joy and the celebration that can happen. And to know that there is the possibility of the transformation of the suffering. Does that answer your question? Jeff?
So when you first became a priest, and then also when you received transmission, how did it support you or change you? Or, my question, if I can just put it kind of mundanely, did you feel like, now I gotta get my act together, or something like that?
Yes and no. I mean, I think more when I was priest ordained, I had a lot of kind of big sort of expectations about thoughts about, like, okay, what am I supposed to do and what am I supposed to be? And I think I was more not sure what the word is, but I really had a lot of preconceived ideas about that. And maybe that's why the robe was floating up there somewhere. And how it supported me, I guess some part of me just felt it was just, kind of the next step. It was just the next step. And like I said earlier about intention, I had no, like when I started sitting, I had no designs or ideas or anything about becoming a priest or not becoming a priest or, but I think how it supported me was that it, in that whole process of kind of discernment and as it took shape into a request to be ordained, I think I realized that I wanted to be able to give myself to practice and to supporting others. And again, you know, the giving and the extending and receiving, that supported me. That felt like a support. And when I had the opportunity to do that and work with people in supporting their practice, that supported me. So in the giving is the receiving. That makes sense. And so this is just kind of like a continuation, and it just seemed to be what was happening. So. Anybody else? Okay, well, thank you very much. I really have enjoyed being here this evening with all of you. Thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.